Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truths listeners. Get ready for a Homeland Security conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. Homeland security, as in making sure our homeland, the United States of America, is secure. The Department of Homeland Security was created in the wake of the September 11th attack on our country nearly 24 years ago. The new federal agency brought together the individual agencies working on a common goal. Thinking of 9/11, it makes sense that Homeland Security focused on Saddam Hussein and ISIS. But today, we can add fentanyl and drugs as a key threat to our homeland and our citizens. On 9/11, nearly 3,000 people were killed. For that, we went to war. Today, 70,000 people a year die from fentanyl, an equivalent of over 23 9/11s each year. We didn't go to war for those Americans. We passed around naloxone and encouraged MAT, medications for assisted treatment. And don't get me wrong, naloxone and treatment is important, what I do every day. But it's far from the response I would expect for this fentanyl attack on America. President Trump has declared drug cartels foreign terrorist organizations. That's the type of action expected after an attack on our citizens. The president is also closing gaps in our border on land and on sea, and that should place a good dent in the drug supply. Given a decrease in drug supply, we should anticipate an increased need in people who are cut off from their supply and are desperate. This is an important opportunity to connect those people to addiction services. Families Against Fentanyl and other advocates believe that we should go beyond declaring drug cartels terrorist organizations and declare fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. I'm proud of the Ohio State Senate, who unanimously passed a resolution February 27th for fentanyl to be designated a weapon of mass destruction. The Department of Homeland Security is important. In addition to their day-to-day work, they are investing in the agency's future through education. There are several universities around the United States who have graduate programs from the Department of Homeland Security. To learn more about Homeland Security education, I reached out to Bob Harkins. Bob Harkins is a former DEA agent who now leads the graduate program in Homeland Security at San Diego State University. You may have heard me give him a shout out on several episodes in the past, as he assigns episodes of High Truths to his students as part of their curriculum. Listening to High Truths is literally a master's class in addiction. At the end of the year, Professor Harkins invites me to the classroom. And as a surprise end of the year guest, I get to meet his students. They ask me questions and I ask them questions as well. Professor Harkins has done extensive teaching on fentanyl and drugs to an academic audience, to law enforcement, high school students, and the community at large. Harkins serves on our San Diego Credo community, community response to drug overdose, so I chat with him at least once a month, and now we get to chat together on a podcast. To learn more about Robert Harkins, check out the High Truths show notes. I recorded this conversation with Bob on February 28th, 2025. Bob Harkins, welcome to High Truths.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you.
Well, this is a special treat because we talk to each other regularly on our on the Credo Task Force that we serve on, so at least once a month, and we meet on projects, and we've known each other for a long time, and I get to finally have you on this show.
It's wonderful. Well, we both know that I used this show as a teaching and learning objective and opportunity for my graduate students at San Diego State, so it's wonderful to be a part of the show. Definitely grateful and honored because you have so many just wonderful guests, right? I mean, really, it is a great learning opportunity for my students in sharing the different shows, the different guests that you have, covering a wide variety of topics. And I know today we're talking about Homeland Security and San Diego State, and then how we met too. We can cover that as well.
Yeah. And by the way, thank you so much for inviting me. I'm like the surprise guest at the end of the semester to meet your students. It's such a treat for me because I love hearing, you know, the impact because they're all assigned different things and they have, and I don't even do a presentation. We just do questions and talk to each other. And that is so refreshing. And I love learning from them. I mean, this is the young generation of new law enforcement leaders. And I get a lot of tips from them, and they make requests for shows, and I follow through. It's awesome.
Well, it's wonderful to share in that environment, and you're so right. And graduate students are wonderful, but what is so great about that is I invite you in as a surprise guest at the end of the semester, so they've had an opportunity to review some of the shows and the podcasts, and then my requirement for them is to create a single one-page PDF fact sheet based upon what they've learned from the show, and then build in the, you know, connections or links to various sites that are part of that podcast episode. So when you enter, it's like a rock star, right? Because they pour themselves into this, they want to get a good grade, and then suddenly you're there physically in person and they can ask questions of you. So it's really just a neat opportunity. You're a great friend of the program. And I have to mention Dr. Frost, who created our graduate program in Homeland Security, is such a wonderful man and so appreciates you. So I know he'll be super excited to view this episode and have, you know, San Diego State and our Homeland Security program, you know, as a part of what you do, so we can share that to San Diego and beyond, right?
Yes. Yes. Special shout out to Dr. Frost. He had a lot to do with, you know, for you in your second part of your career. And for the program, and he's also a treasure. Let's start with your background. You got into law enforcement. Were you like paying cops and robbers as a little boy? Or?
Yes, I was. I just had a flashback, you know, to the little police car running around in the dirt, you know, when I was a child. So yeah, that definitely it was something that I didn't have any family in law enforcement. So it wasn't, you know, as if I were, you know, following the footsteps of, you know, my father or anything. So it was something that just generated an interest to me, perhaps TV shows or whatever it was. And then I had two really, really close friends, and the three of us decided to take a law enforcement class our senior year in high school, which was just a wonderful opportunity. It was taught by a sergeant and a lieutenant. At that point in time, I was in Illinois, just outside Chicago, and we took that class at a community college. And I know we offer pathways, you know, as well, you know, similar to that in San Diego. But I look back at that and it was so neat because, you know, what were we, 16 or 17 at the time? It was neat to have police officers, and this is what we told ourselves, is they really treated us like adults, right? Like mature adults and gentlemen. And we thought, wow, what a great career opportunity this is. And what they did is much of what I'm doing and what we're doing by bringing practitioners in to our program in San Diego State in my classroom to share what people do. So both of these gentlemen did that, and it was just a wonderful experience. You know, I tell my students, certainly it's about learning, but I say it's more about discoveries. And when you can break through the academic bubble, bring people in that are working in the environment, right? Practitioners to talk about what they do day to day. I think that's the best way to share. Because it's the next generation, right? We're preparing our next generation of professionals. So, I mean, the podcast like this is wonderful. We can share and in the classroom. So that was my first experience with law enforcement one-on-one. And I just took that and ran with it. So I became a law enforcement officer in a small town outside Chicago. And both of my friends did it as well. So I worked in that small town for 10 years and then transferred on to DEA as a special agent. And worked for 25 years with DEA. And now I've moved on after retirement in DEA, been blessed to have been offered a position at San Diego State in the graduate program in Homeland Security. And I completed that program myself in 2021. and now I'm a lecturer and academic advisor. So just bringing a wealth of experience and colleagues, connecting colleagues with our program that I think, are so important, especially to our region and what we do.
What were some of the key, you and I met when you were with DEA, and at the time the prescription drug epidemic was a big problem. Me as a physician and my colleagues, we were the supply chain for that. That's how we connected. And, I had my research at the time on the death diaries, and we created programs so we could get all the community together, and bring in physicians as partners in the solution, not like you're the bad guy. And people really, physicians in other communities were surprised at what you're working with law enforcement. Aren't they the ones who put you in jail? It's like, no, we're partnering on this for the population. And we had really a special relationship, I think, medical community and law enforcement in San Diego that maybe not has been shared in other places. But are there other things that you worked on while in DEA, kind of reflecting on your time at DEA?
Oh, absolutely. And you bring up some wonderful points. So I was hired on in the Los Angeles Field Division, and then I became part of the Riverside District Office. And I worked there for almost 15 years. But it was during that 15-year time span where we started to see that shift from heroin to OxyContin, the opiate abuse, and working in a field that DEA agents weren't used to working in. And that was working with the medical community. And I will say, just overall, what we're doing here by layering professionals, right? Because DEA and law enforcement can't do it on their own. You know, we've got to bring the health, sector into it. We've got to bring certainly safety and security sector into this. We've got to bring all of our community efforts, good parent teacher associations, behavioral health with the counties, different cities. So it's a collaborative effort to, reach that goal line, which always seems to be getting greater because the bad guys, the terrorist organizations, the criminal organizations are always moving that goalpost, right? And it always seems like we're chasing it. I first experienced in 2007 the OxyContin and opiate deaths, an increase in Riverside, and that expanded back towards LA. And I was asked by our supervisor at the time of the Riverside District Office to move into a position with what would be our civil investigators, our diversion investigators. So they're non-sworn investigators typically, and they focus on diversion investigations, sort of a funny word. What does that mean? So really it's the pharmaceutical industry side. Certainly when I think people are probably, wondering what DEA agents do, they're thinking about agents, typically like an FBI agent, a federal agent that investigates cocaine, methamphetamine trafficking, heroin trafficking, which we do that. But there's a whole other path, a whole other side of DEA where we have investigators that investigate the companies that manufacture controlled substances. What we do is we audit those individuals, those companies. We work with pharmacists. We provide DEA certifications of registrations, which you well know as a doctor, for doctors. And we provide training and certification for doctors.
Yep, I have a DEA license.
There you go. Yeah. So even as an agent at that time in 07, I really wasn't even aware of that part of DEA because I was just so primarily focused on what you would, somebody would consider just the traditional DEA path, the illicit substances, correct? So at that time, we really needed to make a shift, and we did within DEA to create tactical diversion squads. So what it was a merging of a field agent, a special agent with diversion investigators. And what we were doing is we had to target what we called bad doctors. So doctors that were overprescribing beyond a legitimate medical indication. I'm sure you've heard that before. And when I talk to people about this, what's so interesting is it's the same federal charge as if you're, if you're out trafficking a kilo of cocaine or you're overprescribing OxyContin, it's the same federal charge and statute, right?
Right.
There's no legitimate medical indication for that.
I think that what we did is we And when we talk to the medical community, it's not like, okay, I wrote a prescription. So I remember one time I came, an investigator, DA investigator came asking for me in the middle of my shift in the emergency department. That's really scary. But he wasn't there to get me. He showed me some pictures and he said, do you recognize any of these pictures? And I immediately recognized some patient that I saw that I gave a prescription of drugs to, and who was a doctor shopping. You know, it's like, if I knew that he was shopping around for drugs, would I have still written that prescription? And it's like, no, I wouldn't, right? So that was part of the investigation. But it's not, you weren't going after doctors like me. Right. These were people who were like sitting at Starbucks and writing 300 prescriptions a day to people who, you know, came and, you know, I don't know, charged $300 per prescription as they're just sitting there without, you know, a regular exam or even an office. I remember we called him that Starbucks doctor.
Yeah, you were exactly right. And, yeah. And it was easy to select those. And behind the scenes, everything was tracked via documentation. Because all of those prescriptions, especially in California, we talk about prescription drug monitoring programs, which you probably have, you know, I know on previous podcasts, you know, over the years. So we were able to monitor that. So it's very easy to see the outlier, the doctor that's really over prescribing. And when you get down and writing a search warrant and you realize that a doctor is writing a prescription about every 2 minutes, you realize that they're in no way taking the time to meet with a patient, to go over their history, to go over their health, to look at, you know, tests and imaging, you know, that say if they say that they're injured, you know, where that requirement for that OxyContin, which oftentimes, I mean, such a potent drug, was being overprescribed. So certainly, no, I mean, whatever the percentage could be, you know, 99.9% of the doctors perfectly fine, but it was very easy for DEA to pick out those doctors who were overprescribing, who are charging, you know, $200 or $300 a prescription. And then when we conduct surveillance, you know, it was just really what I would say is a slam dunk because you have a line of people outside the door. And I remember in one case, and it was really the case that I'll highlight here. I was working with Murrieta Police Department at the time, and they were conducting traffic stops on what would be drug traffickers. And when they were searching the vehicles, they were finding prescription bottles of a Dr. Lisa Singh, who was a doctor of osteopathy out of Roland Heights. So it's just a natural question, what are we, maybe 60 miles or so between Murrieta and Roland Heights in this area of Southern California? So quite naturally, you know, the narcotics officers in Murrieta were asking themselves, why are people in Murrieta going to a pain doctor 60 miles away? If you're in pain, you're likely going to go to the doctor that's closest to you, correct? So we just took a look at that, and it was just, you know, a very significant, but
her case was really egregious, right? Several of her patients died. I mean, she had a, you know, really disregard to human life, and she was charged with murder.
Correct. Yeah. Yeah. We were able to charge her with second degree murder in 3 instances. She received 30 years to life. That was a struggle to do. Because you take a look at, you know, the doctor's profession and the doctor-patient relationship and what that means for DEA, undercover operations that we had to conduct. And I'll tell people, in conducting so many undercover operations in what would be the traditional landscape with the coke, meth, and heroin, and we work with informants and we worked with undercovers, in my experience, we were never checked for a wire, right? I go to do my first diversion undercover investigation, and our informant walks out and he says, they just checked me for a wire, and it was in a doctor's office. And I said, you've got to be kidding me. That's unbelievable. So there was the knowledge, there was knowledge and intent that what they were doing was wrong. And this was, you know, we were targeting cartel members in what would be the more traditional environment. In this environment, we're targeting doctors and pharmacists. Very sad.
And the pharmacy with the Dr. Lisa's case, they got charged too, right? They were in on it together.
Yeah, you know that there are some recent cases, I believe CVS and Walgreens, I know we could probably Google that real quick, that they were charged by DEA because they have a corresponding responsibility, right? Mm-hmm. And again, vast majority of pharmacists were on our side and helped us in that effort. because they picked up the phone. They actually called us and said, wow, this is my third prescription for an individual who walks in, who looks rather healthy in that moment, you know, who's whatever, 22 years old, who claims that they were in a car accident, just in a short conversation with a pharmacist, you know, who's getting 200 and who's getting what? 100, what was the actual prescription? I'm trying to remember what it was, like 180 Oxycontin. And the pharmacist is just looking at this person like this does not.
Yeah. The drug supply was the prescriptions. And it was a really difficult time for the medical community because, again, 99% of the doctors are good, but you're like, oh, am I in trouble? Am I going to get my license threatened? But, you know, the cases that came in front of your desk, these were bad guys.
Really bad, super egregious. And this was new territory. You know, this case, I worked at the beginning federally, and the difficulty here is meeting with, and this was the first time in my career that emotions really hit me. I remember when I started my career, my dad talked to me. He says, Bob, don't take the job home with you. Only advice he could give me. He wasn't in this environment, right?
That was very good advice.
Which I did for the majority of my career, really, until I started these doctor investigations. And when you meet, it's obvious, right? You meet one-on-one with family members who have lost a loved one. So unexpectedly, it was crushing. It was tragic. And we'll talk about agencies, I mean, not having enough time, not having enough people. I mean, I was the lone special agent in the diversion group in our office that started to attack this and immediately found myself overwhelmed. So what I naturally, the logical move for me was to reach out, and I did this with a number of narcotics units at various police departments in the Southern California region, because I was the only one, quite honestly, with a badge and a gun. I could certainly try to bring some of my colleagues in from the Riverside District office to help me, but obviously they were busy. But we needed to conduct so many surveillances that I needed to tap into the resources, which I think DEA does a wonderful job of linking up with local and county law enforcement. And they were just as shocked as I was. You know, the narcotics officers and sergeants, you know, were responding, what do you mean we're investigating we're doing surveillance on a doctor? You know, they were used to this stereotypical, you know, street drug deal in an alley, you know, in a corner, you know, whatever, at a 7-Eleven. And the next thing you know, we're conducting surveillance, you know, in a corporate, high-end corporate area of a city in a doctor's office. And they're wondering, what is this all about? So it was really a shift and a dramatic one, and something that we had to respond to rather quickly, because we had somewhere in the neighborhood of 20 overdose deaths. And we were working with coroners, medical examiner offices, and investigators who were also contacting doctors' offices, because they had to conduct their report. And they're wondering why a person of this age was overdosing and really what was the medical indication behind this. So back to your point, when DEA visited you, what I gather from that is what we experienced is the person receiving the prescription would take half and then sell half. And that was how they made their money. And they would go to that doctor that they selected, who clearly was overprescribing. That's why you would go on surveillance and you would see a line outside the door. And they were legitimately, you know, receiving drugs, you know, as if they were receiving them from a cartel member and then selling those on the street. The families, extremely overwhelmed, were searching and reaching out for law enforcement help. And we couldn't just go kick down the door to a doctor office, right? We really had to be savvy with our approach. And the best route of approach for us was, as we started the podcast and talking about the certificate of registration, is to complete a request through the civil end of DEA for the DEA administrator to revoke that registration for the doctor so they could no longer prescribe. So that's what we did. Best thing we could do, she was allowed to maintain and keep the door open to the doctor office, but she could no longer prescribe. Then what we did is we executed search warrants where we went in and we retrieved patient files that needed to be reviewed by expert witnesses on the prosecutorial side, which takes a great amount of time. And maybe you've done this yourself as an expert in some of these cases where we needed another doctor to evaluate the prescribing practices of our targeted physician to say, hey, this is an outlier. In other words, would you, Dr. Lev, have prescribed in the same manner, right, the same way that this doctor did? And we would evaluate, we would take your notes, your recommendations, and then apply those towards that case, and then had to shift from civil to the criminal investigation.
Right. So you were kind of like, I think things were getting better when you transitioned to education and Department of Homeland Security. So I want to, what is that? What is Homeland Security?
Boy, great question. Very broad. So boy, we're all older, right? Older and wiser, as they say. So, I mean, you take a look back, tragically to 2001, 9/11, and what resulted from that. And one of the things that resulted from that was the creation by Dr. Frost of a graduate program at Homeland Security at San Diego State. I believe that was the first brick and mortar Homeland Security program in the nation. And at that time, and what I tell my students now and other people that I speak with, we're seeing that again now in this environment that we're in America, back to Islamic terrorism with the situation with Hamas, Israel, even Ukraine, where the terrorism is back on our radar, so to speak, again. So in the 2001-2004 timeframe, obviously the terrorist situation and combating terrorism was, I mean, the number one concern for the United States. And that's really what created this Homeland Security, I would say, pursuit, right? And that's what created the Department of Homeland Security during that time frame, as a result to say, you know, hey, we probably weren't doing what we should have. Oftentimes we learn, unfortunately, tragically from these times. And then we move to make an effort to make ourselves stronger and more secure. And the way the government did that was creating the Department of Homeland Security. And we're a part of that through San Diego State and our graduate program in Homeland Security. And we partner in research with the counterterrorism. It's a DHS Center of Excellence at the University of Nebraska, Omaha on counterterrorism research gaps. So
you could see the department was created to deal with terrorism, the terrorist threat of 9/11. But now we're talking about fentanyl.
Yeah, because you take a look at the drug environment, and for criminals anywhere across the world, drug trafficking is never underestimate your opponent, right? So whatever your goal is, whatever your illegal activity is, you're always searching to make money. Drug trafficking is a wonderful way to do that. And we see that across the world. And I don't think that DEA is a very, very small agency, but I think we have somewhere in the neighborhood of 70 foreign offices. We do really a wonderful job of networking, and we need to, and training of law enforcement agencies across the world. And we'll bring them into Quantico, we'll bring them into our DEA Academy, and we'll vet them, we'll train them on how to attack drug traffickers in terrorist organizations. You know, logically, you know, countries like Britain, the European countries, don't require as much, I would say, boots on the ground effort from DEA. Much more of that is in the intelligence realm where we assist them. But when you look at South America and some of the third world countries, we have operators on the ground working, and at this point, primarily it's with military organizations or branches of military with some of these governments, because they just don't have the law enforcement resources available to them. You know, and here recently we've seen where our military is now responding to Mexico, and we have, you know, military operators training, I believe it is the naval military in Mexico. And we're very adept at that. We can definitely do that. And oftentimes it's at the request of that.
So you were mentioning that we were kind of chatting right before we started this show that there are some exciting things happening with the new administration and with Mexico. Is that what you're talking about?
I am. And last year, and I know you were a part of a webinar that we complete, and we're looking ahead. We'll have another webinar on counterintelligence, counterterrorism that we co-host with the University of Nebraska, Omaha. Their center is the National Counterterrorism Innovation Technology and Education Center. The acronym for that is NSITE. And just a wonderful group of colleagues, of PhDs, doctors, researchers, graduate students who work directly with DHS, who fund that institute, and then provide a smaller amount of funding for our program at San Diego State to link students, graduate students, and conduct in smaller ways research gaps that our students complete looking at terrorism. So the conversation that I know that we had last year in our webinar, which focused on fentanyl, was looking at fentanyl and classifying that as a weapon of mass destruction. What did that mean, right? So now we're shifting, I would say, along that path now with the designation of cartels as foreign terrorist organizations. And what does that mean? Well, we look back to the conversation we had last year. What that does is it opens a pathway not only for law enforcement to contribute to this fight, but also to our military to contribute to this fight. So it's just an added resource that we need. It's going to assist Border Patrol in a variety of different areas. So we'll be able to assist in. And what I think this new administration is doing, and what I've seen as well just in mainstream media, is opening a dialogue, a conversation with those countries that are having difficulties where we can offer assistance, from a law enforcement perspective and a military perspective, that at the end of the day really help secure our safety, right? Through DHS and other agencies, governmental agencies, we're looking at, our domestic security, whether that's products that are coming in through our ports. And, that's where there are, looking back at some of the cases DEA works, when you're talking about drugs, pharmaceuticals that are not real, or maybe they come from China, come from Pakistan, where people are ordering those online or through the dark web. And they're coming in, misbranded. They may come in as anything. I've seen drugs come in, illicitly through our ports, that are branded as Christmas ornaments, right? Because the number, the volume of what we
get. I saw the pictures of the burritos with the...
Yeah.
With so it's fentanyl-packed burritos.
Yeah, because, think about it, and we see it every day. The organization, the bad guys, so to speak, can think way outside the box, right? And think of, multiple different ways, and they do this. Whether you're tunneling, actually under the ground, into the United States, or you're thinking of various ways, to enter our ports, through containers, through shipments, and misbranding of, different products that in fact do contain, pharmaceuticals or illicit pharmaceuticals. They're very, very good at that.
So we're 1 month into the Trump administration with a lot of focus on the border, sealing it up. Are you seeing a decrease in the drug trafficking across that border?
Most definitely we are. And the initial thought there is CBP, Border Patrol, was just so overwhelmed with dealing with the number of asylum seekers coming in that they really couldn't be proactive. For a number of years, they were reactive. Really, really tough. And the cartels and the criminal organizations took advantage of that. So what we've done is we've paused that. We've been able to realign through our agencies. And you've probably seen that where we've been cross-designated, we being DEA and ATF, cross-designated to help DHS agencies, Homeland Security, CBP, Border Patrol, where we can execute search warrants, arrest warrants, and work in combination, align with DHS, where we wouldn't normally have those powers to help, leverage our ability and numbers to really be proactive. So that's the reason that you're seeing the numbers decreased, because it's really what I would say a cross agency leveraging an attack of better numbers of people, where before we could only be reactive.
And we're in San Diego, close to the Mexican border. Are you seeing, you were mentioning collaboration between the two governments in order to get to these cartels?
I'll tell you.
And in the supply. And
there are two pathways to answer that conversation. First, San Diego State has wonderful relationships, and we know this now within the academic community. And again, what we talked about is layering, with different organizations, different agencies, non-governmental organizations, where you're not just approaching Mexico from a law enforcement standpoint, but working through university connections. San Diego State works wonderfully with higher education in Mexico. We work with them on a daily basis. We have students that are transborder students that predominantly are from Mexico. Part of our program in Homeland Security is based out of our Imperial Valley campus, which, I talk to people about that. Literally yards from the border. All of the students that attend that program are from Mexico that are looking for an opportunity. In all likelihood, they'll probably work for maybe a private security company, maybe for a defense agency, for a law enforcement agency here, either in California or America. But their family is based from Mexico. So we deal with Mexico really, really well on a daily basis. There's always that state level, that conversation, and that could vary, as we see from tariffs and deep conversations about how governments relate to one another and how they have those conversations. What I see from, a field perspective is that the dialogue is opening, but there's that thin blue line. And I've seen it so well. And so well received in the academic community, where you have like-minded individuals. Nobody wants to respond to tragedies or deaths or terrorism or drug trafficking in their areas. And whether you're a law enforcement official or you're in the academic realm, maybe in the School of Public Affairs, criminal justice, administration of justice, you have a number of wonderful people that are trying to attack this at the academic level. And then you layer that over, with obviously, to think that, okay, well, we need more people. We need more law enforcement. Well, we do, but we also need more advocates within the academic realm. And then outside of that, certainly within teaching, right, within the classroom, we advocate, a Say No to Drugs program. Or what does that look like? Educating our youth and what it means. I know you've had Rocky Heron on your show. There are so many wonderful colleagues that we know that are attacking this on many different levels. So yeah, so there we work really, really well with Mexico, especially at an academic level, to have those discussions and to help one another through academia and really through private sector.
Yeah, I think people who are maybe not from San Diego don't realize it, what a relationship we have. Real intimate relationship, right? I could tell you, working at a hospital, we have staff that live in Mexico, but they cross the border and work in San Diego. It's just it's cheaper to live, or their family is there, and they're American citizens, but they choose to live in Mexico.
We have a cross-border conference yearly. Yeah. So last year I was in Mexico and attended a conference in Mexico, which was just a wonderful opportunity for me. But again, you see, and the colleagues that we work with, and you've interviewed many in podcasts, it's the ability to help others, right? Yeah. And to share in that ability and share resources that we have. So yeah, we definitely are capable of doing that.
And our community is shared. That's absolutely what, the things, yeah.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
So focusing now about your academic program, HSI program, What is that? I imagine that if Homeland Security is doing an academic program, it's because they're investing in the, next generation of leaders.
Exactly right. Exactly right. Yeah. So we offer it's 30 credit hours, and we have four core courses that we'll teach. I teach a science and technology class, and what I do is I really tap into the DHS Science and Technology Directorate, which offers just wonderful information. I want to say there are probably about 10 different laboratories within DHS. We partner very closely with the Chemical Science Analysis Laboratory out of Aberdeen Proving Grounds. And they look at chemical security analysis really almost worldwide.
Well, that sounds fascinating. What does that mean? What is chemical security?
You look at fentanyl. I mean, you look at any chemical that could be used, you know, by a terrorist organization, you know, to cause harm, you know, to people, or let's say to a port or a secure area. So they work very, very closely with our DOD. I mean, not a lot of people would
DOD, Department of Defense.
Correct. Yeah. So what we do is we bring in those resources, those people, to talk to our students. And we have a class on law. We have also a very, very good class on emergency preparedness, where we actually work in a mock or a practicum where we work as an emergency operations center. And this year, this will be actually at the county emergency operations center. We'll hold this class. And that's just a wonderful opportunity for students to work through a mock tragic disaster event.
We do that as an emergency physician. And
could be a tsunami.
Dave Rivas, our producer, as a working at EMS, we would practice every year. We would practice big earthquake, shooting, airplane crash. But a new thing that I don't know if San Diego did this, but other communities have, is practicing for a drone fentanyl attack that's over a stadium.
Wow. That is so interesting that you mentioned that. When I attended University of Nebraska in Omaha, there are graduate students looking at drones, and this particular research was looking at drones to attack our infrastructure. But you bring up drone technology, or, you know, what does that mean, right? So that adversary could attack us in a number of different ways, right? Either at the border, infrastructure, through fentanyl. So yeah, what I would say, UAS, UAV, drones are a big part of, I'd say the Homeland Security community, you know, and looking at that as a manner or a way to attack the United States. And what does that mean for our defenses, right? I work well, I think Chula Vista PD, we work so closely with them. I believe they were the first police department nationally that started a drone program, and just a wonderful, you know, resource for our program as well. So what we do is we insert these core classes, and then we also have elective classes, and two important elective classes are cybersecurity. Cybersecurity right now is a big conversation, you know, not only in our region, but really nationwide and worldwide. When you talk about AI, I don't think we can go a day without starting, you know, our day, you know, whether it's an Elon, you know, Musk, you know, driven thing or idea, you know, what was it, DeepSeek, the Chinese corporation that challenged AI and whatever their seemingly cost-effective approach to add AI in open AI and what AI could do in terms of quick searches.
So the cybersecurity discussion is not just like, you know, our hospital was hacked kind of kidnappers, right? They hijacked our electronic medical records and, you know, wanted millions of dollars to be able to get, right? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they do, right? They've gotten into federal
Absolutely.
Systems.
Yeah. So these are high level, highly trained criminal organizations. Some are state based. And what I mean by that is backed by countries, whether or not the country would, you know, admit that or not.
Yeah.
And or nation based attacks.
And that's like China, Russia?
China, Russia, North Korea. Mm-hmm. Yep. Exactly. And then there are lesser groups, and you know, some of this is driven out of the dark web. But are attacking us daily. I mean,
is that by like social media, like creating trouble on social media, or in other bigger ways?
Oh, exactly. You know, social media attempts we see. You know, and many of us are probably see this not maybe in as much as our personal emails, but our work emails, where our IT department or our IT security officers and department will send out emails or even training about phishing attempts, right? So it's going to be maybe an email that resembles an email that could come from a superior, maybe even from an IT department that's asking you to click on something, or they may need something. They may need some of your personally identifiable information, which I think broadly, most people are aware, you know, not to provide that or second guess it. And what you would do is if you receive an email like that, you know, you send that email back, never click on that link, right? Because what that link does is that opens you up to that organization, right? So that they can access your data. And that's something that's going on every day. And the critical infrastructure and the protection of that is something that DHS looks at every day. So a big part of what I've seen, you know, getting back to our Homeland Security program and the creation in 2004, over the years, there's been a change, right? Generational change. So, you know, now we're looking at students who are looking to be analysts, right? They're looking at what I say are the ones and the zeros, because it's not that just the defense contractors or, you know, the logical thought of, you know, the government agencies that need assistance in the cybersecurity space. I tell my students it's virtually every company now, right? Why? Because every company has servers. Every company has data that they need to protect. Now, it's not like a Lockheed or a Boeing that might be working on a top secret, you know, device, you know, or drone technology for the government. It could just be PII. You know, it's our own personal information. It's information within the company itself that they naturally need to protect. And that is a treasure trove of information. And thinking back, you asked, did they, you know, or have they hacked government? And they did years and years ago. While I was with DEA, when it was OPM was the Office of Professional Management was hacked. And what they gained access to was all of the paper applications back in the day. So much of that is digital and online now. When I applied for my job as a special agent, SF-86, the standard form SF-86, well, they gained access to all those. And it wasn't as much about the person, but about the references, right? So my family, my friends, all their information, their addresses were hacked and stolen. Looking at that, yes. You know, what I say came from that, it, you know, is probably they were taking a look, you know, in a way to blackmail people in the government. And then as well, where they weren't successful there, my thought is they probably sold off that information to lesser criminal organizations. And I saw that, and my wife saw that. Our credit cards routinely were used. You know, our address was, you know, routinely used, you know, in efforts, you know, by others, you know,
whatever,
steal our identity, whatever. So that was driven directly from that hack or that unfortunate release of information back in the day from OPM.
So let me ask you, at our recent Credo call, our Community Response to Drug Overdose Committee that I chair, and I get to see you every month, but we talked about online pharmacies, and really shocked to learn that only 5% of online pharmacies follow our American standards and regulations. And we immediately went into action and created a guideline to share at doctor's offices and at pharmacies to really warn patients, because I didn't know that. I don't think most Americans knew that. Is that a type of cybersecurity? Does that fall under that category? Because I see DEA, you know, when you and I met, okay, the doctors were the supply chain. We're not anymore. Nothing's perfect. I'm sure there's still some bad guys on there, but that's not what's fueling the problem right now. Right now, I don't know if there was a new little agency, like you were saying that you were alone in going after doctors at that time, bad doctors. Now we have this flu of online pharmacies, and I don't know if we're going after them. That should just be shut down.
Yeah, no, you're right. You know, that would be, you know, the diversion side of DEA that would be looking at that, you know, as well as our partners with the FDA, you know, as well. Yeah, oftentimes we're overwhelmed, you know, when you see this new phase or generational change, you know, within any corporate environment. And again, AI is advancing us in that way. There are so many wonderful advancements, right? internet technology, the fact that we can, you know, Zoom, you know, together like this, hybrid technology for academics. So it is wonderful. And these advancements are wonderful for the medical community as well. There's always that slight chance.
There are bad guys out there. There's the evils.
For a criminal organization or individual to try to take advantage, you know, of that new environment. So you're exactly right. We have to come in and we have to protect that. And one of the things that we're starting at San Diego State and we're very proud of was we partnered with Google on $1 million grant along with San Marcos State and National University to have our students work with Google mentors and look at under-resourced companies within the San Diego region. And what I mean by that is certainly the largest companies within San Diego have resources and have information technology officers to help protect their data. But I'll use an example of, let's say it's a, you know, attorney office. They may have 10 or so attorneys, and then suddenly they realize, boy, we have, you know, they're working their law cases. Maybe some are criminal, some are civil. But naturally, you think they've got protection. They have to protect their data. They have interviews. They have client information. They have witness information that they need to protect. And suddenly, you know, at a meeting, they may say, wow, are we really protected? Could somebody come in and hack us? They're a small company. They may not have the financial resources to bring in a specialist. So what we're doing with the cyber clinic, the CCOE, within San Diego is we're partnering with three universities and graduate students to help under-resourced companies, where our students will work with this under-resourced company free of charge to provide what it would be a penetration test, or you take a look at their digital footprint, and we'll look at their company and, you know, any adversarial attempts that they could experience in all likelihood. And we'll plan out a defensive, you know, a plan for them and what that looks like. So great. And why is it great? Because it's a savings of money. Not only does the under-resourced company get this professionally completed report, but it offers the students the ability to, what again I say is, it gets up, get outside that academic bubble to work in the real world workspace with Google mentors on this project and deliver a project. And it goes towards their culminating experience, towards their master degree. So just another example of how we leverage different parts of our community, academically, private sector, to come together and say, boy, how can we merge our resources together that make us all better? So that under-resourced company is protected. And what I tell my students, and it's just a logical thought, you do really, really good work for a company, you might get a job offer, right?
Oh, absolutely. That's how they vet you.
Nobody knows you better than that opportunity to work closely with one another and hand in hand. Look, we all look great on paper. Our resumes and our curriculum vitae, our CVs all look great, right? It's what we can do when we interact in person. Yeah. And when we can share and work together in that space.
It's a working interview, really.
Working interview, exactly. Yeah. So we're super glad to offer that opportunity to our students as well.
So Bob, let me let you show off about your research. Okay, what research happens, like maybe even just sales. What does research look like when it comes to Homeland Security? What does that mean?
Yeah, so where I gain those leads are directly from the University of Nebraska, Omaha, and what we would call research gaps. Simply, that's research topics. So I'll give you an example. So one of the research topics that came about was October 7th, right? That tragic day, that attack, right? Israel, Hamas. What does that look like, though, in terms of, and we experienced this, what would have been, what, last summer, and the protests on campus. So how did that really materialize?
Right? That was planned. That was all orchestrated.
Exactly. Where did the money come from? How was it orchestrated? Was that orchestrated within non-governmental organizations? How did they attack? And we know over the years, academic institutions and environments are prime space. And I'll say this first in a good way. And Dr. Larson, who is the co-director of our program and just a wonderful person and such a great colleague, tells me, he says, Bob, the academic space is wonderful space, the best space to have these conversations, right? It's safe space to ask these conversations, to bring in our partners and talk about solving real world problems. So we see universities and we see protests, and we've seen them over the years. Unfortunately, some of these protests turn violent. Some of these protests, unfortunately, are, I guess, poised to create uncertainty on campus, or to spread misinformation.
Well, I mean, I could tell you as a Jewish person that families and people are, you know, really looking to that. Like, what university I'm going to go to, it's not like what your major is am I going to feel safe on campus?
Absolutely.
Because so many schools you're not.
Yeah. So in speaking to that, DHS asked or inquired with Insight, say, here's a question for you. What does it look like, not in Israel, not in any other country, but domestically here in the United States as a result of that attack? What are we seeing domestically, right? What are we seeing? And we focused on what that looks like within the university environment. Who is behind that? Now, there are members in Congress that were looking at some of the dollars that may have been put forth to support these protests, and that some of the dollars to support the protests may have actually been government dollars provided to organizations that were misaligned, that weren't who they said they were, who are actually behind some of these protests. Wow. So you really have to take a look, and that's where we go to with this research, and who was behind that? Who was the motivating factor behind that? So the research topics and gaps that I receive for my students, and I have them complete poster projects. We can't dive into what would be, I think, the stereotypical traditional research where you're picturing in your mind, you know, I'm working for it, a doctor, a PhD, and I'm a graduate student, and I'm working for a number of years, or I'm even in a doctoral program, right, where I'm working 4 years conducting research and data and surveys. Unfortunately, we don't have the time to get that in depth with it with our 2 year program. So what I've done is I've taken it and I've sort of reduced that to a level that's attainable for a student, where I have them actually using AI in combination with their own research to look at research gaps that are driven through Insight that look at a variety of different research factors. It could be cartel influenced terrorism. You know, we have that debate of, okay, is a drug cartel really a terrorist organization? You know, in terms of ISIS, right, or Al Qaeda, how does that differ? What does that look like? What is the definition of that? And what does that mean for our security here in the United States? Very, very deep conversations. Well, what I'll do is I'll pose that question to our students, and what they'll do is they'll complete poster projects. And then at each conference that Insight has, there's a poster competition that the students can enter, in order to have their posters. It's a great opportunity to share their research, but then they'll receive scholarship behind that, monies behind that, travel to the conference to share their poster project research. And it really gets back to what I have the students do in terms of viewing this podcast. Information and information technology moves at such a fast pace. One of the things that I think that the students or a graduate student needs to be able to do is to quickly disseminate information. And we see that through these fact sheets and throughout DHS and government, and maybe you've seen them as well, or maybe we see them in a lot of different of our career environments, is just a one-page sheet of information that is an easy, quick read, but also has links to other information. So I think it's important for our students to take a look at some of these research gaps and get used to putting information in. Sometimes it's tough because you have to filter or narrow information down to a one page or one poster, whatever media environment. You know, it's not what you would consider, you know, the traditional 100 page research paper, although we do have that potential requirement within our program. But you take a look at what the real world is offering. And I know we've got Lieutenant Colonel that is a one of our faculty members, and he talks about a story that a student shared with him about a general who was looking for what it would have been isolated information, and he received 3 pages of information and kicked it back, whatever, to the unit, and said, they came back with 2 pages, and he kicked it back, and he said, no, give me 1 page. Give me 1 page of the most important information that you can get to me on 1 page. And that is what we're seeing. That's what we need. And it's that, that information that sharing in that realm.
And it's a skill.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's one of the build outs that I have, or learning objectives I have in my class. And certainly we have the traditional thesis research papers. But I'll tell you, on the cybersecurity, on the emergency management side, I think we're well represented there, you know, within our program. And I'll tell you, we're closely aligned with the Naval Criminal Investigative Service. They've hired 4 or 5 of our students.
NCIS, maybe they'll make a TV show about you, Bob.
who will play me? We can take a look at who that might be. So yeah, it's wonderful because you look at the geographical region that we're in, and we're in such a special area of the country. I mean, not only for whatever our weather environment, I mean, we're so blessed to be here, but you just take a look at all the different agencies that we have here, you know, academic, you know, colleges, UCSD, USD, right? You know, our community colleges are great, but we have every federal agency represented, as well as many private sector defense contractor companies. So you take a look at our region, and certainly the health sector as well is a big part of that.
That's, offer many opportunities. Your program is that you're integrate. You have all these connections for your students. It's amazing.
Well, a student doesn't have to traditionally go into a law enforcement because they're in Homeland Security, you know, anymore. And again, it would be that cybersecurity pathway that really opens up the door to anybody, you know, a Kroger, a Penny's, a Sears, you know, obviously any pharmaceutical company would certainly, you know, offer career opportunities on that IT cybersecurity side to protect
everybody
their data.
Needs that.
Because everybody needs that.
That's right. So you and I could like chat forever. I want to close with the HSI TV series. And tell us who your students are, because your students are amazing. They have amazing backgrounds. Each of them are different. And so maybe
They are so wonderful. And you're exactly right when we opened the show that you can learn so much from your students. So graduate students, obviously older in age from undergrads, many of them are already working. You know, I've had agents, you know, in my class, you know, working for the government. I was a DEA agent when I went through the program. So you have varying ages, varying backgrounds, which is wonderful when you get everybody into the room, because you can have just these meaningful and very deep conversations, right? I would say overall, maybe about a third of military looking to separate from the military, maybe looking to, you know, as I was at the time, you know, you want to be able to be competitive within your career, right? Whether you're looking at advancement. So having that master's degree is obviously one way to do that. So a lot of the people, the students that we see in our program are already working, but maybe they're not working at their dream job, right? So they're looking to move up or to move on, you know, maybe with a defense contractor or, you know, with an agency. So what we do and what I've done, what we've seen, and through SUOPT and many of our colleagues, is I looked at our program and I said, how can I connect, right? How can I tether our graduate students to our regional agencies, to our coworkers, you know, our colleagues, you know, in our sector, what we call stakeholders. So I was able to do that this year, which was so wonderful. And I know that you were a part of it. So one of our students worked with the DEA, and we looked at the very unfortunate fentanyl poisonings and the interview of families who lost loved ones tragically. And where we could do better in, I would say, what the mental health and behavioral health side of San Diego County. And I will say this, and I think you've said it before, almost in every meeting I say this, we do this so well in San Diego, right? I've seen other sectors, other parts of the country, and they use what we do here as a model. And we've both spoken to this at conferences and other Zoom meetings. So I'm very, very proud of our effort. But at the same time, you always have to be looking to advance in what we can do better.
Yeah, we can always do better.
So it was at that DEA summit 2 years ago where we attended that together. And I think the overarching theme takeaway from that, from just a tear-filled room of listening to parents talk about their loved ones and how they weren't able to get resources that they felt that their loved one needed. So I brought that back to my students and I said, here's a research gap. Let's try to attack this. Let's call DEA. Let's see if we can enter into this with DEA respectfully and see if we can link ourselves to these families and conduct some research and interviews to get firsthand knowledge of where we could do better as a community. And our student did that. And then they ended, they reported what was this, beginning of January, I believe we had our student speak to an SUOPT with a healthcare task force subcommittee.
And SUOPT is Substance Use Overdose Prevention Task Force. That's our countywide task force with over 100 partners that we bring together really to save lives in San Diego on the issue of drugs.
Yeah. So we were able to link that student up and provide that research gap or that research topic for the student, which was wonderful. What I call it, I call it actionable. So there are two pathways for a student to, one is to their final project, either the traditional research paper that you might think of, and then we have what we consider a capstone project. And what I wanted to do is try to make these and collectively as a program, our capstone projects actionable in the best way possible. So what could a student research and do that could really make a difference for us and our stakeholders regionally? I've got another, I haven't seen this build out yet, but I'm anxious for this. We have a student that's working with the San Diego County Sheriff's Department, and she's working on a project for them. Because collectively what we see as agencies, and we all know this, again, and I mentioned it earlier, we don't have enough time. We don't have enough resources, right? We all think of ways that we could do our job better. And you're thinking, wow, if we only had the time to do this, or somebody could take a look at that. And that's exactly the environment that this student is in, looking at an issue or a problem, for the county, or otherwise they wouldn't have the time or money to look at it. But the student, by nature of being enrolled in our program, has to complete a culminating experience and is taking a look at an issue and solving a problem for the county that otherwise they couldn't solve. So I really think it's just so important. It empowers not only our program, but really allows us to give back to our community and link ourselves academically, with our private sector and stakeholders that are there in San Diego.
Yeah, that's great. And Bob, Professor Harkins, this has been a great conversation. Thank you for joining the show, but also involving me in High Truths with your students and with your program. It's really an honor to play a role in that. I look forward to meeting them and having their ideas and their feedback. And thank you for your many years of friendship and collaboration.
Our friendship, our relationship, and all of our colleagues are so special, and we work so well together. So you're very gracious. I'm honored to be here, and thank you for the opportunity.
Right, and may we bring the DEA Museum to San Diego. We've been working on that forever. We got to make that happen.
I will send an email today, another email. So I am on it.
All right. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.